Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula. Berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. And right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
What happens when America's dad is revealed to be a perpetrator? Actress Lily Bernard knows all too well. On this emotional episode of Navigating Narcissism, Lily bravely opens up for the very first time about the horrific abuse she endured at the hands of Bill Cosby. When Lily first met Cosby in 1989, she was just beginning her career. He, on the other hand, was one of the most famous, respected, and beloved men in the world. Since then, over 60 women have accused him of sexually assaulting, drugging, and raping them. In 2018, Cosby was convicted and went to prison before being released on a legal technicality less than 3 years later. His crimes have been the focus of documentaries and news articles, but the experiences of the survivors are often glossed over. What did the grooming process look like? How did enablers and systems psychologically conspire to allow him to keep perpetrating for decades? Even more important, what happens to the survivors for years afterward? While this is a story of sexual assault, abuse, and perpetration, it is frankly also a straight-up story of narcissistic abuse. This is Lily's harrowing journey of surviving Bill Cosby. Not just what happened, but what has happened to her since, and the reality of her healing process. This podcast should not be used as a substitute for medical or mental health advice. Individuals are advised to seek independent medical advice, counseling, and/or therapy from a healthcare professional with respect to any medical condition, mental health issue, or health inquiry, including matters discussed on this podcast. This episode discusses abuse, which may be triggering to some people. The views and opinions expressed are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent the opinions of Red Table Talk Productions, iHeartMedia, or their employees. Thank you so much for coming, being here.
Thank you.
Here's where I'd like to begin. I truly believe that one of the most difficult things about being a trauma survivor is that people want you to keep sharing the story of the trauma. What I'd like to have happen today is your story and your experience as a survivor. This is about you. And keeping that in mind, where do you want to begin telling your story?
I think the context is a good way to begin.
All right.
I want you to know I do feel safe.
Okay.
And I do get invited to do a lot of interviews on the subject, and I usually decline, but I feel safe with you.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that.
So I guess there's a greater context that's cultural for me. I'm a Cuban-born immigrant, and my heritage is African, Caribbean, Chinese, and European. And of those first three cultures, you know, Black, Latin, and Asian, it's really, as you know, against the status quo to speak about sexual assault.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because society, the media, is constantly denigrating the image of men of color, particularly Black men, and so we're deeply invested in protecting that, rightfully so. But unfortunately, in my case with Bill Cosby, where that played a personal role is, yes, all that came to play, but it's not about race here. It's not about protecting the Black male image. It's about rape. And rape crosses all sociocultural, all racial boundaries. I found that personally. So that's the context from which I'm coming that's really difficult. Because unfortunately, those Cosby fans and rape apologists who've attacked me the most in public, sometimes in person, with raised fists, death threats, and rape threats have been Black men. And that's really painful. You know, I have six children that I birthed in a 10-year span, and five of them are young Black men. So that's really a sad reality.
With that context, because one of the first places I go when I hear that is not only is rape or sexual assault not allowable as a topic of discussion for people who have your heritage, who have my heritage, women of color aren't believed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's really like an added burden, very painful. One thing that Bill Cosby did for me personally was to make me... I'm sorry.
You take your time, Lee.
Both of my parents are mixed Black people.
Yeah.
And like a lot of Black Cubans, I grew up with a deep-seated, learned racial self-hatred that you're not Black, you're mulata. And I'd go to school when the kids called me nigger, and I'd come home and tell my parents, and my mom would say, well, go tell them you're mulata. And then they laugh at my face, my American, you know, classmates, dummy, mulata is a nigger. So I'd go back home to my parents and I'd say, but they say mulata is a nigger. And my mom would say, well, maybe in America, but in Cuba, it's better than a nigger. So I grew up with that stigma, you know, that pain, that not understanding, and I loved my Black heritage. I gravitated towards it. I knew I was Black. My hair is naturally kinky. And so when I met Bill Cosby, and he would talk to me really academically because he knew that I loved my Black heritage. He knew that I was Cuban, a Cuban immigrant. He knew that I identified as being Black and Latin. So he heralded that. So Bill Cosby played a role in really making me feel proud to be Black, among so many other things that he made me feel good about. Does that make any sense?
It makes absolute sense. I wanted to ask you, growing up and battling within you, this battle around racial identity within you, how did that shape your identity, not only as a child, but then ultimately as a woman? I want to understand that piece first, and then because I fully understand the profundity and the power of somebody seeing that part of you, right? All we want, Lily, is to be seen.
Right.
Right? And he saw a part of you that you were told not to see.
That's right.
That is a revelation, right? When somebody does that for us, and we will feel drawn to that, and it will almost create an accelerated sense of trust.
Yes, it did.
How do you think, though, grappling with that shaped you as a human being to have had those conflicting and actually brutalizing messages about race that you received?
Yeah, it's, I guess what my therapist has called the cognitive dissonance, you know? Yeah.
Cognitive dissonance is the tension we experience when things are inconsistent. For example, we love someone and they hurt us. At those times, we will often justify or try to find the good in a situation. For example, they didn't mean it, or even maybe I remembered it wrong. It is painful to recognize that someone we trust is harming us. And cognitive dissonance means that we will make those puzzle pieces fit, even when it hurts us.
So whereas I'm born into a culture, mm-hmm. you know, Afro-Cuban culture, we were immigrants living in Princeton Junction, New Jersey, yeah. trying to assimilate and trying to hide our blackness. There was all this shame, right, growing up. I mean, like one time my mom was braiding my hair. And I was 12. I had no idea I had a natural afro because she would always keep my hair braided. Mm-hmm. And my little baby brother was crying, so she went to the room, and my hair was out in a big afro. The doorbell rang, mm-hmm. and it was one of my blonde neighbors in Princeton Junction selling Girl Scout cookies. And I opened the door, and she went, "Wow!" Mm-hmm. I was like, "What? Mm-hmm. Your hair!" Mm-hmm. I was like, "What?" And I looked in the mirror, and there's this gigantic afro. That's my natural hair, a gigantic afro. She's like, "Your hair, it's so beautiful." I was like, just, you know, throwing my afro around. My mom came and she saw me. She said, "Cochina marrana," which in Spanish means "you dirty little pig." Mm. Slapped my face really hard. "I told you not to open the door." Oh, the shame that our white neighbors would know that I really have an afro. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's where I'm coming into a trauma that's really deeply embedded, where Bill Cosby saw my blackness and elevated and said it was good. "Yes, you're Latin. And yes, you're black. And you're beautiful. You're great. I see you as my daughter." And then Bill Cosby was not unsimilar to my dad in appearance. You know, my dad's a black man. Bill Cosby is black. My dad wore glasses. Bill Cosby wore glasses. My dad had moles on his face. Bill Cosby had moles on his face. You know, I had suffered some really serious life-threatening abuse from my dad in my childhood through my early adulthood. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at Bill Cosby as a replacement father figure. My father changed the last 25 years of his life, and he became a very loving father, very, very remorseful for the abuse that he put me through when he was, you know, drunk.
When we have these difficult relationships with parents growing up, we do gravitate towards parental figures, right? The challenge for you, though, was the parental figures were also abusive. How did you first meet Bill Cosby?
I was acting at Cornell University. Wanted to be on The Cosby Show, you know, because it stood for so much in America.
What did it stand for you?
For me, it stood for excellence, black excellence. Mm. I mean, that's an expression that's said a lot, but it stood for black excellence.
Yeah.
And it showed the world that black people are not any different than white people, mm-hmm. that we have hopes and aspirations mm-hmm. and high achievements and vulnerabilities and problems mm-hmm. like dyslexia. And to see a couple where there were two black professionals raising this family of five children mm-hmm. in New York City, when we moved to the United States, we moved to Brooklyn, New York, you know, so we lived in a brownstone. So that was all very familiar to me, that New York City life. And so it just meant hope. It meant greatness, it meant advancement, but really that black excellence. And that's what The Cosby Show represented for me. Mm-hmm. And so ended up doing a silent bit in a season in the fall of 1988 with Betty Carter.
Oh, the singer.
The jazz singer. Yeah, it was her guest role on The Cosby Show. And what was interesting in retrospect is when I did that little bit role, that she kept me in her dressing room the whole week. And that when Bill Cosby came into her dressing room, she literally put her arm into my arm and held me really tight. I did not understand then why she was really holding me tightly, but she was treating me as if I were her granddaughter or something like that. And Bill Cosby came into the room multiple occasions, and we spoke at that time about jazz, because she was a jazz singer, and about the influence of Cuban jazz in New Orleans, because he knew that I was Cuban. I told him I was Cuban, and it was just a really beautiful, again, intellectual talk about jazz from a global perspective, since I was Cuban.
So is that where you met him?
That's the first time you met him.
It
was 24.
You're 24, okay? What's interesting to me is that your draw to wanting to be on something like The Cosby Show really came from a very thoughtful, intentional place. So again, you were coming out of a top university. You're clearly an academically gifted person. You were classically training as an actor. And through sheer force of will, you're like, I'm going to be on that show. Mm-hmm. And you were on that show. Mm-hmm. And so he meets you in this dressing room. And it's there that he's having conversations with you about your Cubanness. And, mm-hmm. and so he's getting information about you. Mm-hmm. You just think it's a conversation. Mm-hmm. But it was a very different process for him because mm-hmm. this felt like intel gathering, mm-hmm. like information gathering. And yet simultaneously, you're having an incredibly, it's a notable experience that this older woman, as you said, in these communities, in this case, the Black community, you don't talk about this. She was doing something, you know, that it was almost like, how do I protect one of our children mm-hmm. in this community, but couldn't say it.
Right. But when Bill Cosby came into the room, I can honestly say that I wasn't really like starstruck seeing him mm-hmm. because I was so just like basking in the comfort of being with Betty Carter, like mm-hmm. I was her granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And that was beautiful. But I do want to say that having had that bit part on that show that time and meeting the crew, it was predominantly Black. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw for the first time Black everything. You know, Black makeup, Black hair, Black yeah. wardrobe, Black stage designers, Black stage managers, Black director. Some of the writers were Black. And it was so exciting to me.
Yeah.
So I said, I want to be back on this show, but I want to come back in a speaking role, mm-hmm. in a principal role. Mm-hmm. So 2 years later, I saw an ad in Backstage, which is the trade paper for actors, and it said that they were looking for stand-ins for The Cosby Show. So I went, and the line just really wrapped around the whole block, Kaufman Astoria Studios. And when I finally got in, I had prepared a postcard with my picture on it, and I wrote a little note saying, thank you, Mr. Cosby. You know, I was on the show 2 years ago as a silent mm-hmm. bit, but I really want a principal speaking role on your mm-hmm. show. Mm-hmm. And I gave it to him. And I believe same day, when I got home, he called me. And so that summer, he spent hours a week mentoring me. And that's where what did you call it? Investigation into the really
intel gathering.
The intel, yeah. Woo! I mean, it was as if he were a news reporter. And so the first few meetings, he was just gathering information from me. And I thought that he was just really genuinely interested in me, mm-hmm. so I would tell him everything, and mm-hmm. he must have asked me hundreds of questions. Mm-hmm. So he knew everything going in. He knew the abuse that I suffered as a child and young adult in my home, the domestic violence. He knew my feelings of worthlessness. He knew that, you know, I was a member of the Abyssinian Baptist Church and all these things, and that I didn't drink, I didn't consume alcohol because my father would abuse me when he was drunk. Mm-hmm. So he knew mm-hmm. that because I told him, but I mean, so many things. He knew that I was a visual artist, so on some occasions when he invited me to the mentoring, he asked me to bring my artwork, and I would bring my artwork, and we'd have discussions because he told me that he was an art collector, so we'd have discussions about my paintings. I also, in high school and in college, I played clarinet in the classical band and flute and saxophone in the jazz band, so he encouraged me to take it back up again. Mm-hmm. So he helped me to find out where I could get flute lessons, and it was so exhilarating because my father was also an academic. He was, mm-hmm. you know, electrical engineer, mm-hmm. math professor. Mm-hmm. My siblings are PhDs, and so academics and art, we're like a very high vibration
yeah.
art and mm-hmm. intellect family. So it was really exciting to see another Black man like mm-hmm. my dad, mm-hmm. who was mm-hmm. a creative and an intellect. Mm-hmm. It felt familiar.
Yeah, it felt familiar, but it also felt healthy.
Yes.
Lily, I think that, you know, that survivor stories tend to get very pathologized on the back telling. Weak, vulnerable, you just wanted someone to pay attention to you. That's not it at all. You came in your full strength, fully possessed of your Blackness, which you'd been denied of for so long, wanting to explore that in a creative space. A mentoring person is meeting you where you're at intellectually. That is what is so insidious about what this person did to you, is that they exploited your strengths.
Sorry.
You okay? Take a minute.
You know, it's so many years ago, but it's like it was yesterday.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm sure it is. I mean, I'm feeling it here with you. And I just, again, so smart. And that was being harnessed by someone. And you didn't know that at the time. you're going into this as though it was a trusted interaction.
Back when it happened, you know, like the betrayal was so deep. It happened in the early 1990s, the assault. But then by 1992, I was so traumatized by the betrayal that I actually ended up in the psych ward from the trauma. And then I didn't understand. Like, part of the pain was like, oh, my God, he loved me as a daughter. How could he do this to me? But he loved me, you know, and so I couldn't understand how someone who had professed to love me so much as his daughter. No, he used to say, you're one of my kids, Bernard. You know, I love you like a daughter. You're one of my kids. And so I didn't understand that. And it wasn't until, you know, fast forward 2 decades later that I started to understand he never loved me. It was fake. It was phony, you know, and that has helped me to process better the betrayal, you know, that it wasn't really love.
We will be right back with this conversation.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of 2 clinically studied ingredients in 1 revolutionary formula: berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
But I thought it was paternal love.
Right. You were being told it was paternal love. It felt like paternal love. And I'm not convinced this person is capable of love. I'm sorry. People say, no, they might love in parts of their lives. Maybe I'm hardcore on this one, but no, that capacity, there is no love there. And
it clearly was, you know,
using the word doesn't make it. So was your mentoring all in person?
Or
all in person?
God, yes. Mm-hmm. I thought then that he was obsessed with me because he would call me so frequently, and several times a week he would have me come to his brownstone in Manhattan.
Where he lived.
Yeah, where he lived, to mentor me and put me through these exercises that were theatrical exercises. He also had me come to the Cosby Show studios, and he would mentor me at the Cosby Show as well. He would mentor me in his dressing room studio at the Cosby Show. He introduced me very early on to the entire crew as someone who is a studied actor, you know, who's academic, who's performing off Broadway, as someone who, for whom he was going to write a role, a main character. And so I very quickly had meetings with the producers, with the writers, with the directors, and that felt like also very empowering. He gave me free rein of the studios because he said that when I act on the Cosby Show, I had a huge responsibility to uphold because it's the, you know, the number one show in the world. And then he also, of course, invited my family to come to the studios with me. So he invited my dad. He met my dad, and he invited my brother, my sister, her boyfriend at the time, my cousins, friends. You know, it made it all the more difficult that when he did drug and sexually assault me, it made it the more difficult for me to then tell my family who met him and to whom he was really nice to them, you know. And
he was a big name in the culture. I think that we can't underplay this, is that that was a nefarious move no matter what, right? Because in essence, by bringing your family into the fray, they get to meet this sort of cultural icon. That was all with the goal of isolating you, because now you've lost a source of support.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it was still going to be very difficult because he was so iconic. But then by adding that other layer of, look, I'm going to bring you in, I'm going to give you the VIP treatment, they're getting to meet this person, it's creating these bonds and then fostering more isolation for you. It feels so calculated and so intentional over such a protracted period of time. When your family got invited, at the time, were you suspecting anything strange?
No. My dad, being a Black Latin immigrant, to see another Black man,
in such a powerful position mm-hmm. meant so much to my dad. So when mm-hmm. my dad met Bill Cosby on the set, I'd never seen my dad look at somebody mm-hmm. like that with so much admiration mm-hmm. and gratitude. Mm-hmm. And Bill Cosby was telling my dad, you know, how wonderful your daughter is. I'm going to help her become a star because she's such a great yeah. actor and she works hard. He called my mom on the phone. My parents were living in Spain. Mm-hmm. And so he called my mom in Spain and assured my mother that he would take care of me as if he were my father. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. even though my parents were living far away in Spain, you know, they felt so good mm-hmm. that he was taking care of me.
They must have been so proud of yeah. you. I mean, you, what did it feel like to watch your family's pride in you, watching your career blossoming on such a world stage at that time?
I guess it meant a lot because of the abuse I suffered as a child. I was yeah. always looking for their approval mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and nothing that I could do, whether it was going to an Ivy League college or being first chair clarinet or first chair saxophone or being a, you know, award-winning USGF gymnast, all of which I was, none of that would make my parents treat me with the love and respect that I merited, as any child would. So that achievement was like, look, mommy and papi, look, I'm worthy, you know,
yeah,
I'm worthy.
Yeah.
My acting career is not just a whim, a hobby. It's mm-hmm. I'm really serious about it. And look at this mm-hmm. great, mm-hmm. this great person telling me that I have talent. So it meant so much.
I'll bet it did. And it is, I mean, it really must have been a moment of pride. And at the yeah. time, you weren't suspecting anything.
Oh,
so
not
it was
at all.
Just, it was a big moment. And I think that that's also so complicated about trauma, right? In that moment, without knowing what you would know, it was a profound, powerful moment for you in your life.
Yeah. So there were three druggings and three sexual assaults. And in the first one, the betrayal was so profound. That was in Atlantic City.
Mm-hmm.
And just made absolutely no sense
no.
that I was actually able to block it out. I mean, completely mm-hmm. block out the memory mm-hmm. in order mm-hmm. to survive. Mm-hmm. Blocked it out. Because, like, there's no way this could happen. Can I talk about a little bit about that one?
Absolutely.
I asked myself, like, why am I doing this interview? Because it's important, you know. But he had already mentored me for dozens of hours and weeks, and means I had no idea that it was grooming. I had no idea whatsoever. So the first incident happened. It wasn't a drugging, but I guess it was what you call gaslighting. So we were in his brownstone mm-hmm. in Manhattan, and he was putting me through these theater exercises that any actor does when they're in acting school, is breathing. But he came up from behind me and he was telling me to expand my rib cage and how to breathe. Like when you breathe in, the diaphragm should go out and lift up your rib cage. He was telling me to, you know, pull my head up high. All of a sudden, he grabbed my breasts. And I turned around really quickly and I was like, Mr. C, because he had me call him Mr. C. That's what I had to call him, Mr. C. Not Mr. Cosby, definitely not Bill Cosby. So I turned around and I said, Mr. C. I said, you grabbed my breast. And I was shocked. And he said, I didn't grab your breast.
Mm.
I was like, yes, you grabbed my breast. He said, no, I didn't. I said, you grabbed my breast. And we went back and forth a few times. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. And he was, I guess, such a good actor
yeah.
that I was like, I actually ended up believing him. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking, geez, that's really terrible of me. He must yeah. have accidentally grabbed my breast. He must have been meaning to grab my rib cage. And this is what he said. I grabbed your rib cage.
Mm-hmm.
So I was mm-hmm. like, okay, well, that was probably an accident. You know, he probably meant to grab my rib cage. He would never do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Shame on me for thinking that he would do that. And then later, he told me that I had to meet with a producer, a mm-hmm. white man, who would further my career. And that we had to go to the Trump Taj Mahal Hotel in Atlantic City. So he said that the Trump Taj Mahal Hotel was new. Michael Jackson had just been there, and that's a place where celebrities go to have meetings. And I remember telling my cousin about it, and she's like, why do you want to go? Why do you have to go to Atlantic City to meet a producer? You live in New York. Cosby lives in New York. This makes no sense. Can I come with you? And so I asked Bill Cosby, can my cousin come with me? She lives in Princeton Junction on the way. He's like, no. So my cousin was telling me, I don't know. This is fishy. Don't go. And I'm like, I'm going to go, you know. So Bill Cosby sent a car to pick me up at my apartment, and the car took me, whatever it was, a couple hours from New York to New Jersey. And then when I got there, yeah, there was a producer with whom I met. We were in a dining area. There were a lot of chandeliers, and Bill Cosby came back and forth to the table a couple of times. It was just me and the producer talking, and about my career, mm-hmm. and about the aspirations that I had, and everything that I was doing with my career. And I had every reason to believe that this man was going to advance my career mm-hmm. as a producer, and so thankful to Bill Cosby. And we had lobster, and then we went up to a suite, a very big suite. So when people criticize you for like being in a hotel room, let me tell you that anytime I've ever been in a hotel with Bill Cosby, which was just twice, once in Vegas and Atlantic City, it wasn't a hotel room.
Right. It was like
talking a suite.
Yeah.
Bigger mm-hmm. than my house.
I was going to say, it probably felt 5,000, like a house.
Like 5,000 square feet.
Big house.
Yeah, 5,000 square feet with a big living room and kitchen and an office area. So we went up to a suite. So I was sitting at a table, like a corner table, with that man and Bill Cosby. And by that time, Bill Cosby had already known that I don't drink alcohol. Mm-hmm. You know, he knew that. And so he gave me this drink, and it was brown, and I tasted it, and it tasted like alcohol. I was like, I don't drink alcohol. So he and the man had a moment that they looked at each other, like, awkwardly, but I wasn't suspecting anything. And then he came back with another drink, but it was still brown, and this time really sweet. Like, maybe he put something
soda
in it,
or
something in it. And he was getting giggly. He's like, drink. You know, again, always to drink to my success, and you're going to be great. And he was literally pushing the glass up my face. And I'm like, oh, okay, fine. You know, he's my daddy, you know, helping me, whatever, mm-hmm. you know, have fun. And then very shortly thereafter, you know, I just started getting groggy, and the room was spinning. And I started, my cheeks on the inside began salivating. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I had food poisoning just a couple months prior mm-hmm. with similar symptoms.
Similar symptoms, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I thought, ooh, was that lobster downstairs
yeah.
full of food poisoning? Am I getting food poisoning? That's what I thought. I had made no correlation whatsoever with him, you know, drinking. I'm like, oh my God, I have food poisoning again. And so like, I have to vomit, and I'm still at the table, and I'm like, and just like it's coming out, and I like, excuse me, Mr. C. And by the time I have to get to the bathroom, I couldn't even walk. You know, he was mm-hmm. holding me up, and I remember walking through this hallway. It was kind of white. There's a door to my left, a door to ahead of me, a door to the right, and I just like got into the bathroom really quickly. Excuse me, I knew I was going to vomit, so he tried to come in with me. I was like, no. And I vomited all over. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a telephone on the wall, which I thought it was strange, a telephone by the toilet. And I'm just vomiting all over my dress. And whenever I would see Bill Cosby, you know, I wanted to impress that I was a serious professional. So mm-hmm. I dressed the part. And it was a Sunday. I had just come from church. And so I was dressed that part, you know, like mm-hmm. a two-piece nice dress outfit. Vomited all over my dress. And then the next memory I have, I must have passed out.
Yeah.
Because then the next memory I have, I'm on a couch. And the couch was, see, this is, the thing is, because going in and out of consciousness, yeah. like I have like sensory memory.
Yeah.
Dr. Ramani, mm-hmm. like sensory and colors. Mm-hmm. And so I remember the couch was like hard. It wasn't like a cushy couch. It was like a hard one. I think there were stripes. I don't know. But then he's like taking off my clothes. And I'm still thinking in my mind, Dr. Ramani, that I vomited. How disgusting. Mm-hmm. How embarrassing. Mm-hmm. I vomited in front of Bill Cosby. Mm-hmm. He's taking off my clothes to help me, to wash it. That's in my mind, right? Mm-hmm. And then he starts mm-hmm. taking off my stockings, and I'm like getting really embarrassed. I'm like thinking, okay. And I'm also drugged. I'm like, okay, he's taking off my stockings. Well, okay, that's okay. Vomit on my stockings. I remember feeling embarrassed. Oh my gosh, I don't have underwear under my pantyhose because it was built-in pantyhose. Mm-hmm. So I started feeling really embarrassed. Oh no, pass out. I don't remember the next thing happening until now I'm waking up. Again, this time I'm on the floor. And this time, it's like a stick was inside of me. And I say stick because I couldn't associate it with mm-hmm. a penis. Mm-hmm. I'm still mm-hmm. detaching Bill mm-hmm. Cosby to whatever horrible thing is physically happening to me. Mm-hmm. So I feel there's a stick inside of me. I'm on the ground. There's like a rug. And I say there must be a rug. I remember a lot of patterns. Like patterns on the tiles in the suite, like patterns, like geometric kind of patterns. But yeah. this time I remember the feeling of carpet on my back. Mm. And I remember feeling like Velcro because as I was getting raped, my back was going up and down. Yeah. So I remember that yeah. feeling on my back. And I remember the brownness of his skin right here on my mm-hmm. left. I remember his face like that, you know. And then I pass out again. Mm-hmm. And then the next memory I have, I'm in a bathroom of some sorts, a porcelain or something jacuzzi. Mm-hmm. And it's light colored, like probably white. It's cold on my back. I'm totally naked and there's water pouring on my chest. And that's how I woke up, to water pouring on my chest. And I remember hearing, "Bernard, you okay?" And I looked to the right and there's Bill Cosby's face in the door. And I pass out again. Mm-hmm. And then the next memory, it's dark, but it's the morning. And he's literally dragging, like pulling my feet like this to the edge of the bed and propping me up, because I had told him I had a performance that morning with mm-hmm. Plays for a Living. It was a theatrical company with which I worked that performed at schools, mm-hmm. rec mm-hmm. centers, summer camps, halfway houses, mm-hmm. programs about drug addiction mm-hmm. and things like that. I played a teenager in it. I had to get to that performance. And it was early in the morning, like 9 or something. But this was like at dusk when mm-hmm. the sun is coming. So he pulls me at the edge of bed. He's putting on my clothes. I was still like a noodle. I couldn't move my hands mm-hmm. or anything. And I'm totally confused what's going on. And he's telling me to hurry up. You have to get mm-hmm. to work, putting on my thing. And then the next memory I have, I'm being walked like by Bill Cosby and a doorman outside to a car that he ordered for yeah. me, I guess. And I get into the car. And I'm, again, dizzy, you know, like, what, confused. And the car driver was starstruck. Like, that's Bill Cosby. And he just, for the whole 2.5 hour, whatever was car ride on the New Jersey Turnpike, he kept asking me, this man, about Bill Cosby. Are you going to be on the show? And all I kept thinking was, what happened? What happened? I looked down at my dress, and there's the stain on my skirt. I looked at my pantyhose, and the ribbing on the pantyhose was all twisted. Mm-hmm. You know, like mm-hmm. I would never put my pantyhose like that. I looked underneath my thing, and the crotch was inside out. I was like a mess. And then thinking like my cousin was right. I shouldn't have gone. What happened? I don't know. Was this a nightmare? Was this, yeah. am I crazy? What happened? I still couldn't say that it was rape, Dr. Ramani. I couldn't say.
Yeah.
No. It was rape. I'm like, mm-mm. some terrible thing happened to me. I didn't know what it was mm-hmm. because I was still holding Bill Cosby in such wonderful esteem, you know, having spent those dozens yeah. and dozens of mm-hmm. hours of him like a daughter and mm-hmm. enamoring my family to him. I just, because the abuse that I endured as a child wasn't sexual, you right. know, it was okay. physical, but it wasn't sexual. So this was all different to me,
yeah.
a father figure doing that to me. So I couldn't connect the two.
No.
And then when I got to my apartment in New York City, I remember I had to change. I remember what I put on. I mean, I remember to the T what I put on. I remember taking off my clothes and putting on this light tan flannel shirt and some suspenders and going to my performance. I remember, like, how am I going to get my lines out? I remember being on the subway, like, where am I? Like, I was trying so hard to be conscious, like, mm. like what I couldn't. Like, it was really hard for me to just be conscious. Like, I don't, like, am I sick? What's going on in my head? Is it food poisoning? Still, I'm thinking I have food poisoning. It's not making sense. And I just made a decision, like, this didn't happen. Like,
mm-hmm. My conversation will continue after this break.
Looking for a healthy, natural mood boost? Boost your health and happiness with Happy Saffron Plus by BrainMD, the 3-in-1 formula for a better you. Happy Saffron Plus was developed by Dr. Daniel Amen, a double board certified psychiatrist and world-renowned leader in brain and mental health. It contains a mix of the most potent saffron, curcumin, and zinc, three clinically studied ingredients proven to improve mood, help support your memory, and decrease stress. Happy Saffron Plus is changing lives. Join the thousands already experiencing a happier, healthier lifestyle. Get Happy Saffron Plus with a special offer at GetHappyToday.com, where you'll find the lowest price available anywhere. That's GetHappyToday.com. Happy Saffron Plus. Make your brain and body happy. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
And so, like, as the day progressed, of course, the drugs wore off. But I was like, okay, that was weird. That didn't happen. Okay, that didn't happen. And I just blocked it out. Mm-hmm. And I was able to do that through childhood, you know, when something, like when my dad threw me through the window or tied me in a chair in a, you know, in a dark basement or knocked me unconscious with a skateboard. I was able to block that out so that I could move forward, you know, with my life.
Yeah.
Because if you think about that stuff, then the alternative is suicide. So I literally blocked it out so much that weeks later, when he flew me out to Las Vegas to meet the producers of A Different World, that's what he said, because as well as being on The Cosby Show, he said that I was going to be on A Different World, which he was a producer of. And so I was really excited about that, and that I would have to meet the directors, the producers, the casting people at the Hilton, the Las Vegas Hilton. And it was the same thing, that meetings are conducted in hotel suites because it's convenient for everybody to meet there. And so that's where I was going to have my audition for A Different World. Of course, when we got there, the producers were never there. Yeah. He had a bottle of sparkling apple cider for me and a bottle of champagne, which he said was for himself. And he told me not to worry because even though the producers didn't show up, you're still going to be on the show. Everything's going to be all right. Let's drink to your success. And so he gave me he poured from the sparkling apple cider my glass, and he gave it to me, and the same thing, drink, 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 push up the bottle up to my face to drink. And again, now mind you, when I'm here, I'm having no memory of what happened. And it's hard for people to understand that, but you as a therapist, I'd like to hear you talk about that.
I will.
Can understand. I freaking blocked the whole thing out of my head. So I had no memory of, at that point, of Atlantic City. And I'm sitting here, and now I'm getting dizzy again. But what do I think this time? He gave me the wrong glass. So I'm like, Mr. C, you gave me the wrong glass. I told you I don't drink alcohol. And so I'm like, and he made me chug it so quickly. So I'm thinking in my mind now, oh, my God, he accidentally gave me a whole glass of champagne. I'm getting drunk. So I start running away from him because I'm like, oh, help me stay awake. I'm starting to pass out. We're running around the table. And then all of a sudden, boom, I fall. Boom. And my left rib cage hits the corner of a coffee table, which cuts me and bruises me. My head goes banging on the floor. And I'm like, oh, my God, how embarrassing. I got drunk in front of Bill Cosby. He's tickling me on the ground. And I don't know why he's tickling, but he was tickling me. And then my next memory is I'm on a bed somewhere. It's dark. And he's raping me. I mean, full blown. And then I pass out. And he did ejaculate on my belly. I remember that I was screaming, no. I was going in and out of consciousness. I remember screaming, no, stop. You know, I'm not on the pill. What are you doing? It was really clear now that Bill Cosby is raping me. And then after he ejaculated on my abdomen, he plopped himself and whispered in my ear, damn, Bernard, you're so strong. You're so strong, Bernard, damn. And I think that's because I was a USGF gymnast. I did karate. I was strong. I tried to the best of my ability to push him off. During the rape, when I was screaming no, at one point he took his hand and he covered my mouth. And I remember there was a lot of saliva on my mouth. I remember the feeling of his fingers on my mouth as he was like saying, shut up, Bernard, shut up. And I was trying to scream. And then he took the pillow and he pushed it into my face. And because I was like incapacitated, my arms were, they felt heavy like lead, and I couldn't move them like rubber, like I was paralyzed. And so I thought at that moment when he was pushing the pillow in my face to silence my screams of no, I thought I was going to die of suffocation.
So consequently, right now, I have difficulty putting my heads on pillows because I wake up in these panic attacks that I'm being suffocated and I can't breathe. I literally can't breathe. And like in Atlantic City this time he went to the bathroom. When he was in the bathroom, there was a light coming in. So I have difficulty when I see lights coming in through cracked doors. And then he came back with a wet towel and he was like cleaning me and rubbing me all around my thighs and down there. And then I must have passed out and fall asleep. When I woke up, there was my clothes neatly folded. He had put me in some kind of a T-shirt. I woke up in a T-shirt that wasn't mine, like some college T-shirt. And then my clothes were neatly folded there and a note with some money. Oh, in Atlantic City, he gave me money too. He like shoved money in my hand before I left. And here he had money again, like a couple hundred, a few hundred bucks, money. And so that made me feel like shameful, like money, like I'm not a prostitute. What the is this money thing? And then, but I couldn't forget that one, Dr. Ramani, because of the bruise and the cut on my ribcage. I couldn't block that trauma out. But I knew enough that I couldn't be in the same room with that man by myself. So I continued to go to the studios because he had promised the role to me because I had met with the directors, the producers. There was talk, but I never was in the room with him by myself again until more than a year later. And he called me and said, okay, we wrote the role for you. It's ready, but you have to come to my brownstone and talk to my agent. And I thought, daylight, afternoon, nothing could happen. And so there, he drugged and sexually assaulted me that time. He didn't rape me. He wasn't successful at raping me. And that's when I made the first connection, because when I drank the sparkling apple cider and I began getting dizzy, I was like, whoa, everything just flooded back into my memory. And that's when I realized, wow, you drugged me. And all the Atlantic City memory came rushing back. You know, you drugged me in Las Vegas, you know, a year ago in Las Vegas. You drugged me a year and a half ago or whatever it was in Atlantic City. And oh, my God. And I had a huge confrontation with him. I told him I was going to go to the police. I was going to go to the hospital and find out what he put in my drink. And he told me, we were yelling at each other in his brownstone. He was telling me that the minute I go to the police, that he would go to the police after me and file a police report against me for false accusation and defamation. He had also said that he would erase me and blacklist me, tell all of Hollywood that I was a slut and a whore and slept my way to the top. He also said he would erase me. He said he would erase me and that all it took is one phone call. I interpreted that he would kill me. He didn't say the word kill. But to me, erase means, you know, something exists and then you erase it and it's not there anymore. So I feared for my life. And he literally, you know, pushed me down the stairs. I had to catch a cab and it was horrific. Even trying to get myself from his brownstone to the corner to catch a cab, I was stumbling and tripping because I was drugged. And I remember holding on to like the lamppost and trying to wave down a cab. When I got back to my apartment, my boyfriend at the time was there who had met Bill Cosby before through me. We both confronted Bill Cosby on the phone and he reiterated the same kind of threats to my boyfriend at the time. And we just like, there's nothing we could do. He made it very clear what he would do to us if we went public. He made it very clear that no one would believe us. And we just, he silenced us both, you know. He threatened us to silence. And that was that.
First of all, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, that was a lot.
It's not easy to share.
Yeah.
Something so interesting about your story is how many details you remember, right? The feeling of the carpet, the stripes on the sofa. That's often used against survivors. Well, you remembered all that. Why can't you remember this? Right? But it's different. It's entirely different. And some of this work comes from a researcher named Dr. Jennifer Fried. When we're betrayed in such a fundamental way, in this case, a person who is a father figure to you, raping you, is such a profound betrayal that she talks about something called betrayal blindness. We actually create a blindness because it's almost impossible to conceive of those things together. One of the things you said to me that stuck with me is I just felt there was a stick inside of me, right? It's a distortion of what was happening, but it wasn't being contextualized as a rape. That blindness of betrayal. So we forget, but we don't really forget. It's a blindness. It's not that we don't see it. We can't see it. And then what happened in Vegas, you fell and you incurred a different injury that in some ways the physiology of that injury is saying, wait a minute, this thing happened. The memory starts to form out a little bit more. But you also have to remember, you were drugged, and that's going to impair your memory process. To remember something, we have to pay attention to it. And that attention for you was disrupted. So there are two things happening. Not only someone giving you some sort of sedative, which is going to impair memory, but then these other trauma processes operating, so we don't form these memories correctly. So you know Pavlov's dogs, right? It's all that. It's this thing we call classical conditioning. The pillow, the light, the carpet, the smell of the cider.
Showers,
they all get
water.
Paired. The shower. They get paired. And they get a power.
Freeways.
Freeways. All these things. They get paired. Mm-hmm. And now you have to deal with the cataclysm of the person who was the father figure, who has all the power, did this horrible thing, and that is a catastrophe in our brain. Next time on Navigating Narcissism. This was more than just Bill Cosby.
Right.
You felt the responsibility of your race.
Yeah.
How did you manage that?
It's hard, and it still is hard.
Yeah.
I get attacked still.
Lily reveals the last time she saw Bill Cosby.
So he starts yelling at me, and in front of everybody, he cusses, "This ain't about me trying to fuck you, Bernard. I already hit that. You ain't shit."
The trauma of his trial.
But it was also really scary being in that courtroom.
The outrage over his release.
That was also like a stab in the back. I felt deeply betrayed.
Her healing process.
I don't think anyone has ever asked me that question.
And the aftermath of suffering silently for 22 years. What was your life like after this?
I was highly suicidal.
Join us next week for part two of my conversation with Lily.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique two-in-one product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula: berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just two capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.